The Paranormal Podcast is brought to you by Club W. Club W is offering our audience members who are 21 and over and who live in the U.S. $25 off their first order and free shipping on 4 bottles of wine as a new member of Club W. So go to clubw.com/Jim to get $25 off your first order when you become a new member. Thanks, Club W. The Paranormal Podcast is also brought to you by Scott Evest. Great clothing plus tons of pockets for your stuff. That's Scott Evest. To learn more and get a super special Scott Evest deal, go to jimherald.com/vest. That's jimherald.com/vest. Click on the link I provide there and use the coupon code JimHerald and you'll get 20% off your purchase. That's one word, Jim Herald. Thanks, Scott Evest.
This is the Paranormal Podcast with Jim Herald.
Welcome to the Paranormal Podcast. I am Jim Herald and so glad to be with you once again. And boy, do we have a creepy show for you today. We're going to start out talking about the Seattle Demon House. Jenny Ashford's going to join us to talk about her new book, House of Fire and Whispers, investigating the Seattle Demon House. But the spookiness doesn't stop there. In part two, we're going to talk to Brennan Storr about his new book, A Strange Little Place, The Hauntings and Unexplained Events of One Small Town. So stay tuned for the spooky, and we'll get started right now with the Seattle Demon House. And here it is on the Paranormal Podcast. Now, one of the primary things we take a look at here are haunted houses, and we're going to do just such a thing today. And actually, it's interesting because we have a little experience ourselves with this house. We're talking about the Seattle Demon House, and we've talked to Keith Linder about that, who lives in the house and his experiences on the Campfire program. And now we have someone on the line who's done her own book on the book on the house and her own investigation. I'm really interested to see what she has to say. I'm talking about Jenny Ashford. She's the author of the recent book, House of Fire and Whispers, Investigating the Seattle Demon House. And this kind of thing is right in her wheelhouse because she's a horror and paranormal writer and a graphic designer. Her books include two paranormal works, The Rochdale Poltergeist and The Mammoth Mountain Poltergeist. Her other books include the horror novels Red Menace, Bellwether, The Five Poisons, and The Tenebrist, and two short story collections, Hopeful Monsters and The Associated Villainies. Her horror blog, goddessofhellfire.com, great URL, by the way, contains current writing, news, short stories, and articles, and her opinions about horror films and the genre in general. But this is true life stuff we're talking about here. Jenny Ashford, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me.
So why did you decide to kind of turn your attention to the Seattle Demon House? And maybe also tell us, what is the Seattle Demon House?
Well, actually, what had ended up happening, I had written The Rochdale Poltergeist with Steve Mara, who's a British parapsychologist, and we had become friends with him through The Mammoth Mountain Poltergeist, which I wrote with my boyfriend, Tom Ross. And Steve Mara had read that. It came to his attention, and he read it, and he reviewed it for his magazine. And we kind of became friends with Steve Mara, and, you know, we kind of agreed to write a book with him about the Rochdale case. So that book came out, and it did very well. And then we were talking to Steve about maybe writing another book, you know, with him. And then it so happened that Steve Mara got called to the Keith Linder House just this past January, the beginning of this year, to investigate his quote-unquote haunted house. And so what they found there was pretty extraordinary. And he actually ended up making two visits there. So we decided to document his experiences there. So I do. The book does kind of go a little bit into what happened to Keith Linder before Steve arrived, but it's mostly from Steve's point of view and his investigation of what they found on their investigation while they were there.
And now that I recall, I remember, I believe Steve even came on our program briefly to talk a little bit about his investigation on one of the calls, if I'm remembering correctly. It had escaped me as I was calling you, but I recall that now, so that makes it doubly interesting for me.
Yeah.
Now, let's get this out of the way, because I think when I've had it on the campfire, people have mentioned this right off the gate when we talked to Keith. Now, if I recall correctly, one of the paranormal TV shows had been out there and kind of wrote off this experiences as not being something that was real. Can you talk about that a little bit? And we can address that right up front.
Okay. So actually Keith had been experiencing things for about 4 years, I think, at that point. And he was just kind of calling in anyone to help or to try to figure out what it was. And to that end, he ended up getting in touch with Ghost Adventures, the Ghost Adventures TV show. Actually, I think they got in touch with him through a mutual friend. And they wanted to do an episode about the show. And they came out there, and I think the production crew were there for about a week during the day, and the main crew, like the guys that are actually on the show, they were there for about 11 hours. And they evidently didn't record anything, except I think the batteries were drained on some of their equipment, like, weirdly. And so when the episode came out, they actually said, well, we didn't find anything. And they kind of implied that either Keith was faking or that Keith's then-girlfriend, Tina, had some kind of negative energy and was, like, causing all of these things to happen or something like that. And actually, the backlash against them was so bad that Keith and Tina ended up breaking up, and Tina moved out. And that was actually kind of the catalyst that got Keith to call Steve Mayer, because he said, I want a serious parapsychologist to come and investigate this, because I know something's going on and I feel like the TV show, you know, made me look bad. And so he wanted some vindication. So that's why that's how Steve Mayer got involved. Yeah. Just because of that experience.
Now, kind of recap for us, what kind of things was Keith experiencing in the home?
Mostly, like most of these types of things, it started out kind of small. It was just kind of like they would hear footsteps, they would hear coughing, like a little kid coughing, banging on the walls. And then, like, things would start to go missing or, like, turn up in weird places, like car keys and stuff like that. And then it kind of started to get to a point where it almost seemed like dangerous, you know what I mean? Like, things would catch fire, particularly Bibles. His office would just be totally trashed. Like, there would just be furniture overturned. There'd be like weird writing on the walls and things like that. And just furniture started getting moved around. Now, he had various priests in. He had a Episcopalian minister in. I think he had a shaman in there. And most of the bigger stuff kind of stopped or got, you know, not, it wasn't as pronounced after that, but there was still a lot of stuff going on after that, but mostly, you know, burning objects, disappearing. Like, one time the tower hard drive of his computer disappeared and turned up the next day, like in a kitchen cabinet or something like that. I think the scariest thing was probably the Bibles burning. Other things caught fire too. Like, one time his shirt caught fire while it was on him, and, corner of a poster in his room, you know, paper that was in the printer would catch fire, things like that.
Yeah, when things start spontaneously catching on fire, then something's definitely up, I would think.
Yeah, you would think. And actually, on one occasion, I think it was when the poster caught fire, the fire department did come out and had to put the fire out, and they could not find any obvious way that it could have started.
I mean, what stood out? I mean, the fire stood out, but what other things stood out to you from your experience and the work that you've done in looking into these things, true cases? What kind of made you think this is different?
The thing that was creepiest to me, and actually Keith was not really aware of this so much until Steve and Don Phillips, who was assisting him on the investigation, until they got there with all their recording equipment. One of the most common things they found was EVPs. They found, I believe it was about 400 EVPs in just the 14 days they were there. And he has played me, Steve played me some of these EVPs, and they are exceptionally clear. These are not, you know, the kind of the ones you see on the paranormal shows on TV that are like kind of garbled. And I mean, these are very obviously voices, and they, you know, it's very obvious what they were saying. And the weirdest thing about it is that when they went into this case, they were assuming that it was some type of, you know, poltergeist phenomena, you know, because of the fires and things being thrown around and rearranged and what have you. But after they had listened to some of the EVPs they recorded, they started to think that maybe this was some kind of what they would call an interactive haunting, because a lot of the voices seemed to be commenting on what they were doing or commenting on their equipment or answering their questions directly. So they're not really sure if that was some kind of like, you know, non-intelligent poltergeist energy, or if it was actually some kind of spirits. And that's kind of what made the case so interesting, is they couldn't really put their finger on what was causing it, because it seemed to be intelligent, particularly the voices.
Well, that's the thing. Go ahead.
Oh, no, it's all right. I was done.
Well, what I was going to say is that's the thing, because a lot of times when you look at these things, you think in terms of residual hauntings. You know, we're just kind of seeing a replay, and I use this phrase a lot, but I love it, the stone tape theory. I actually had somebody transcribing for me, and she wrote stoned ape. And it's like, no, it's not a stoned ape. It's the stone. It's this. That's the Bigfoot show. No, it's a stone tape, stone tape theory. And yeah. The thing about that is I think that is happens in some of these cases, but cases like these, the ones that really, you know, it's one thing if you're at a museum or a old mansion or something, and you see, you know, the Countess of the house strolling through the grounds is like a replay. That's one thing. I mean, yeah, it's a little creepy, but it's not like, oh my goodness. But when things start talking to you and antagonizing you and interacting with you, it takes it to a whole new level.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. And I definitely think those are probably two separate phenomena. Like you said, I think there should be a distinction drawn between, you know, the quote unquote replay hauntings where people see spirits, but they can't interact with them and they just do the same thing over and over, or something like apparently what they found in this case, which these entities, if, or whatever they were, they did genuinely seem to be commenting on, you know, on what the investigators were doing. And they were, you know, commenting on their equipment. And, you know, one of the freakiest things was Don Phillips, like I said, the other investigator, he bought a bouquet of flowers and he put them in a vase, like on the upstairs hallway, which was kind of the most active area. And when they were recording themselves, you know, putting all their equipment around and things like that, because they recorded everything on the investigation. Now, when they listened to these videos, when they watched these videos later, they said there were two female voices, and one of them asked, "Whose are the flowers?" And then another voice answered, "That man bought them." And it's clear as bell. And there were no women in the house at the time. It was just Steve, Don, and Keith were the only people in the house at the time. So, yeah, it was very bizarre. They seemed to see what was going on. It's like they seemed to be watching everything.
Now, it's interesting because I'm really fascinated by Steve's perspective on this. What did he think about this place compared to the many other places he had looked at?
This place, he really thought that, I mean, like I said, he got more EVPs here than anything else. They did see some physical phenomena, cameras turning around 180 degrees and taking pictures of the wall and things like that, like, you know, turning around by themselves. And, you know, the door opening by itself when it was locked and things of that nature. And like I said, he's kind of confused as to what it is because, you know, it seems a lot of the phenomena seemed poltergeist-like, but then, you know, they got all these voices that seemed intelligent. And interestingly, when they researched the history of the area, they found that the plot of land that Keith's house was built on was the only piece of land in the area that had once had a former dwelling on it. The rest of it, he lives in a big, you know, like a big housing development called the Timbers
right.
in Bothell. And, you know, that the rest of it was just all forest that was cleared. But it happens that where his house is was once, there was a log cabin there, and it was built in the 1940s. And they think there was something kind of shady about the people who lived there, but they couldn't really. They know that one of them was imprisoned for embezzlement, and maybe both of them were. But the interesting thing, too, is that a lot of the voices that Steve and Don captured had Irish accents. And they were kind of wondering about that because for a while they were thinking, because everyone they asked about it were like, oh, well, you know, it was a Native American burial ground. There's, you know, the Duwamish tribe lived in that area. And they said, okay, fair enough. But then it seemed like a lot of the voices we're capturing had these Irish accents and they couldn't figure out why. And when they researched the history of the land, they found out that evidently in the mid-1800s, there had been a very large Irish settlement there of immigrants. And they had been hired by logging companies to come over and clear a lot of the land. And there had been actually battles between them and the Native Americans who lived in the area, and there had been some deaths. So now they're kind of wondering whether some of these settlers are still there. You know, although why it's just Keith's house, they're not really entirely sure. Oh, and also previous tenants of Keith's house had reported activity also. So it wasn't a case where it was a poltergeist thing and, you know, someone was the focus of the activity, because, you know, the two previous tenants independently said that they had also experienced similar, nothing like fires or anything, but all of them had heard voices and footsteps and, you know, banging and seen shadows and things like that. But yeah, Steve thought that this was actually one of the most active houses he had ever been in. And he really had no idea why Ghost Adventures didn't capture anything, because he said, we were here 6 days the first investigation, 8 days the second investigation. It's like, we just got mountains of data. And he's like, so I don't know why they didn't get anything, but he's like, it's there. It's definitely there.
Now, in terms of Keith, how does he feel about the book?
He has read it, and he seems to like it so far, so that's that's very good. We did kind of consult with him, and you know, like I said, this is mostly from Steve's point of view, but we did want to make sure that he was all right with it as well. And he seems like a good guy, you know, and we've talked to him a couple times on Skype, and, you know, he seems very genuine. And I know a lot of people kind of, you know, gave him some trouble because they're like, well, why did you live there for so long if it was so scary and all this other stuff? But he seemed like a really curious guy, you know, like he was like, well, I just wanted to figure out what it was, you know, and he's moved now.
Yeah, that was my question.
He doesn't live there anymore.
So, I mean, yeah, what was his, why did he make that decision to move?
Well, here's what happened. And actually, this ended up relating to Steve and Don coming back for the second investigation. After Steve and Don left the first time, this was this past January, the phenomena seemed to diminish a little bit. But it did have spikes at certain times. And there was one of these spikes where Keith began to feel like the entities were targeting him directly, which he had never really felt before, which you wouldn't think that because of all the scary things that happened. But he's like, for some reason, it's just, he's like, I didn't feel threatened before. But he's like, at some point, he started getting kind of harassed in his bedroom while he was sleeping. He would feel like fingers poking at his face from underneath his pillow. His bed would shake. And also he started noticing this weird fluid like dripping down the walls in a couple places. And he said, I feel like it's just getting too much. And it's getting too weird. And I feel like it's attacking me directly, like poking me in the face while I'm trying to sleep. And so he called Steve and Don back. And when Steve and Don got there the second time, this was this past April, they said, well, you know, they got almost as many EVPs as before. They didn't see the physical phenomena that they had seen in the first time, which is the things being thrown around. But he's like, well, maybe Keith overreacted a little bit. He's like, I can understand, you know, getting poked in the face while you're sleeping. That's not cool. And he can see why Keith got threatened by that. But he's like, on the other hand, some of these kind of things with the fluid dripping down the walls and stuff like that, he's like, that's kind of indicative of what they would call a diabolical haunting. And so he said, maybe this haunting or whatever it is taking a darker turn. And maybe Keith kind of sensed that and was like, you know, I'm out. But, you know, Keith just got to the point where he's like, I'm not getting any sleep anymore. I can't take it. I got to work. And, you know, he was just being kept awake all hours of the night and he had to go stay in hotels and things like that. So finally he just moved, and he moved to a condo not too far away. And I've actually heard the landlord, Keith was renting, and the landlord said, well, I probably can't rent the house out again because of all these things going on in there. But I saw that the house did sell, so someone else has bought it. So Stephen Don said, well, we're keeping an eye on it just to make sure that nothing else bad happens there, because, you know, he's like, we don't know if it's going to get worse and get more like a diabolical haunting or if it's going to peter out. So they're just kind of keeping track of it.
Now,
make sure nothing bad happens.
Now, in terms of the house, do you believe that, and this is going to sound like a weird question, do you believe inanimate objects can be evil in any sense? And do you think this house could be, quote, evil?
I'm not really sure about that. Like I said, this is kind of an interesting case for me to be writing about, because if it actually is, I mean, I believe that there's some kind of thing that can cause poltergeist activity, but I don't believe that it's caused by ghosts or spirits. I believe it's the energy of a living person somehow acting out unconsciously. But since this case seemed to have an aspect of intelligent haunting, so now I'm kind of questioning, I don't know if it's the house itself. Maybe there's something, I think it's something to do with maybe the land beneath it. Maybe there's some kind of weird, you know, energy vortex there or something. Maybe there really are spirits there, people who once lived there, and they're causing trouble for whatever reason. I don't know if it's the house itself or if it's, I don't know if I believe that. I don't know if I believe an inanimate object can be one way or the other. It can be good or evil. Like a cursed object you're talking about?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. I'm not sure. Yeah. I don't think so.
Do you ever worry about when, and I think about this sometimes, of course, I'm comfortably sitting here behind my microphone in my home studio, so I don't have to worry about quite as much. Although I had a really interesting experience when I did a show on the gin that day. Mm-hmm. I posted it, and later that day, a beloved uncle passed away. Again, he had been ill, but it wasn't expected immediately, so it kind of threw me for a loop when I did that. But do you ever worry about when you investigate these things and do these things that somehow it may be inviting darkness into your own life? I'm always interested in talking to people who are in these subjects like me about that. Do you ever worry for your own protection?
I don't. And maybe I've been on like other shows where, you know, the host told me that was maybe dumb, but it's not really something I worry about, I guess, because like I said, I'm kind of really skeptical of most things. And the only things I've experienced myself are, you know, poltergeist activity, and that poltergeist activity, the focus of that was my boyfriend, Tom. So since I knew it was coming from him, it didn't frighten me because I knew that that's what was causing it. I knew it wasn't a dead person. It wasn't a demon or anything like that. And like I said, I'm not sure that I can go all the way to like believing that demons exist or that dead people can come back and cause trouble for living people. So I don't worry about it. Now, that's not to say that if something bad happened to me that I wouldn't, you know, reconsider that position. At the moment, I'm not worried about it.
Well, I applaud your braveness. And I don't worry about it that much. I don't worry about it that much, but it does occur to me from time to time, especially after that little experience that just kind of coincidentally happened around releasing that podcast about the djinn, because I hear that they can be rather nasty. Now, if folks want to connect to your blog, all of your books, this book, everything they do, what would you recommend?
I would recommend first going to my website, which is just jennyashford.com. And that has links to pretty much all my stuff. Or you can just go to Amazon and search my name. And I have an author page, and all of my books are on there. And I also have my blog, which is Goddess of Hellfire. And all of my books at the moment, pretty much all of my books are available in both print and ebook. I'm also going to have House of Fire and Whispers is going to be out on audiobook also. That might be another few weeks. And the other paranormal books will eventually be on audiobook also. So if anybody wants audiobook, you know, that's coming too. But at the moment, all the print and ebook ones are out. Amazon's probably the best thing to do. Just go to Amazon and search my name and everything will come up.
Very good. Our guest today has been Jenny Ashford. The book is House of Fire and Whispers, Investigating the Seattle Demon House. Jenny, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, I enjoyed that. And this is interesting because we've had some involvement and conversation with Keith as well. So very curious to see what Jenny found in her investigation and her writings on it. Next, we're going to have up a listener to the show, but he's also a published author. Llewellyn has a new book out by Brennan Storr, A Strange Little Place, The Hauntings and Unexplained Events of One Small Town. We're going to talk to Brennan right after this on the Paranormal Podcast. The Paranormal Podcast is brought to you by Club W. Club W is offering our audience members who are 21 and over and who live in the U.S. $25 off their first order and free shipping on 4 bottles of wine as a new member of Club W. And we're going to tell you how you can pick up on that great offer. It's a new offer. And even better than what they were offering before. So if you've been on the fence, don't be on the fence anymore, because Club W is fantastic. I absolutely love it, because what Club W is doing is they're appealing to people like me, maybe who had been turned off previously from wine by the pretense and kind of, and then this isn't their words, it's my words, kind of the snobbery, like it's unapproachable. You can't do it. These people know too much. Turned me around to 180, because it's a very kind of approachable way of becoming a wine fan. And I can't believe how much I'm enjoying it. It's really great. And the nice thing is that you have this great selection of wines. They come to your home every month, which is fantastic. And they kind of handhold you through this process in such a way that's non-threatening. Nobody's judging you, and you can educate yourself about wines and learn about wines. Now, the first step is you go over to clubw.com/Jim and you take their 20-second palate profile quiz to get instant wine recommendations based on your unique profile. Now, the great thing is that the price for most wines, the price point is about $20. So but for signing up with Club W in this way, you're getting your first bottle for free. And right now I'm enjoying the 2015 Akoya Vignier. Now, believe me, I wouldn't have known what a Vignier was until Club W, because the cool thing is that on their site, when you get these wines, they have these little videos and they educate you about it. And now I'm starting to learn. It is so cool. And I hope that it comes across in my voice that I really love this service, and I think that you will too. So here it goes. Club W is offering our audience members who are 21 and over and who live in the U.S. a $25 credit on their first order and free shipping on 4 bottles of wine as a new member of Club W. You really need to check it out. So what do? You say, how can I pick up on this? Well, very easy. Go to clubw.com/Jim. That's clubw.com/Jim to receive a $25 credit on your first order when you become a new member. Now, of course, you have to be 21 and over and live in the United States. And we hope that you will give Club W a try, because I enjoy it. People who tell me they've joined the club, they say, I enjoy it, Jim. Thank you for telling me about Club W. Now it's your turn. Clubw.com/Jim. Thanks, Club W. Welcome to the Paranormal Podcast. I am Jim Harold, and so glad to be with you once again. And I love small towns. My family was from West Virginia, a rural area, and there are a lot of small towns down there. And I've always enjoyed the vibe of a small town. But sometimes small towns, very prosaic, can hide secrets, and there can be strange things going on. We're going to talk about a town like that today with our guest, Brennan Storr. He is the author of the new book From Llewellyn, A Strange Little Place, The Hauntings and Unexplained Events of One Small Town. And we're really excited to have him on the show. Brennan is a researcher with a lifelong interest in the paranormal. He has written articles for various publications, and he currently works in a haunted office building in Victoria, Canada, the most haunted city on the Western Canadian coast. Former atheist turned believer, he has been subject to an accidental exorcism and has had encounters with shadow people. He's also an avid night photographer. You can find him at largelythetruth.com. And in this particular book, I was very honored to write the foreword. So I'm really pulling for this book. And I think that if you pick it up, you will enjoy it. A Strange Little Place. Brennan, welcome to the program today.
Thanks, Jim. It's a real thrill to be here. The Paranormal Podcast was the first show I started listening to when I was looking for podcasts on the paranormal to try and supplement the meager knowledge I started with. And so to actually be on it is it's pretty cool.
Oh, good. Well, good. Well, thank you so much. And I think you've done some great work here. So tell us about this strange little place, this town you decided to focus on, and why did you decide to focus on it?
Well, the strange little place in question is Revelstoke, British Columbia, Canada. It's my hometown. I grew up there. I lived there from up until about, I believe, about the age of 23. And there was a few ghost stories I told from places I stayed or places I lived when I was there, or stories that were told around the dinner table with my family. And I never really believed it. They were just fun entertainment. And back in 2012, I thought, I'm going to collect some of these stories in one place, sort of a family history project more than anything. As it turned out, most of my family didn't remember the stories they used to tell. But they referred me to other people who had stories. And over time, I thought, geez, I bet there's enough here for a full book. And was there ever? I was bowled over by how much paranormal history I uncovered. Revelstoke has always seemed a little odd. It's a relatively isolated place. It's about 45 minutes to the nearest town in one direction, an hour and a half in another. The roads north and south, both dead end and reservoirs. So it's always seemed unusual, but I didn't quite realize how unusual until beginning work on the book.
Now, do you believe that some places just inherently have more spiritual activity than others, that not all places are created equal? And I'm assuming Revelstoke is one of those places?
You know, I didn't, and now I absolutely do. I think that Revelstoke is most definitely one of these places. I think John Keel used to call them flap areas or window areas, but it definitely seems as though this activity clusters. I know from personal experience, Revelstoke is one. There are parts of eastern Pennsylvania I've also found to be, from personal experience, to be very, very active. And as far as Revelstoke goes, I couldn't exactly say what does it. Of course, I guess that's the $64,000 question, but whatever is there in spades. There are stories of not just hauntings, but UFO, Bigfoot, missing time, gremlins of all things. It's just an absolute cavalcade of all things weird.
Was there something about the history of Revelstoke that kind of lent itself to this?
Not that I can tell. There's nothing about the place itself that suggests, I should say, any kind of paranormal leanings. It was a relatively small town born in the late 1890s. At one point, it was going to be one of the premier cities in the area, but the First World War gutted the working age population of about 7,500 people. According to records, 600 to 1,000 of the young men went off to fight in the First World War, and a significant number of them were killed. And that essentially, as I say, gutted the town. And what was left was just sort of a shell. There was nothing demonstrable, nothing tangible it took, but the city never recovered after that. And whatever spirit survived that particular calamity was then decimated during the Depression. And so Revelstoke is a vibrant little place. It's a very popular little ski town, but it never regained the prominence it was once promised.
Now, it's interesting because I'm looking here at the book to refresh my memory because it's been a little while since I wrote that forward because publishers work so far ahead. But the thing is that 33 chapters, 33 stories here, I mean, per capita, I think that's got to be more ghost stories for a small town like that. It's just amazing.
Absolutely. And there's a chapter at the end called Whispers, wherein I compile all the various things that I heard, but I either couldn't substantiate to any degree or that I just couldn't develop further. You know, being that it is a small town and this is still very much a fringe topic in some ways, people were hesitant to share secrets. So I would hear a little bit of a story, but when I pressed people, they wouldn't volunteer anything. And that chapter is divided into ghosts and UFOs, and there are a variety of phenomenon in there. Not only that, but since having published the book, which just came out on August 8th, I've received a number of emails and phone calls from people who have other stories to share from the area. So I suspect I've only scratched the surface.
Do you think there's I asked you, was there something in the history? Do you think maybe it's where it's located? Is it close to a ley line? I mean, is there something like that? Is there anything at all you can point to?
It's hard to say. I don't know about ley line positioning, but I know it's nestled in some very, very high mountains. And I've been told that some people believe these kinds of activity travel along fault lines, along geographical paths, which are not necessarily visible to the eye. And certainly being surrounded by mountains, we're riven with very old fault lines. So if there is some kind of truth to spiritual activity traveling along those pathways, then certainly that would make a great deal of sense. But whether it's pathways, whether it's portals, it's hard to say. But unless Hotel Transylvania has it right and ghosts, Bigfoot, and mummies like to hang out in the same spot, there is something very unique to that area that produces these kinds of phenomenon. And I think we're only beginning to see the true extent of that.
One of the interesting things is we're not just talking about ghosts here. You mentioned UFO and other kinds of activity. You know, when I've said this before, so if you've heard this before and I'm repeating it, I apologize out there. But I used to think in a very siloed manner about all of this, you know. Ghosts in this category, UFOs in this category, Bigfoot in this category, everything very discreet and separated. But over time, as I talked to more and more researchers, there seems to be some kind of coincidence. I don't mean a coincidence like I bumped into a friend of mine I was just thinking about. I mean coincidence of these kind of events in areas where you see more UFOs, you might see more cryptids. Did you find that to be the case here? Do you think that there's kind of some mysterious thread tying all these different spokes together?
I believe so. One story I uncovered involved a very unusual orange light in the sky, which was preceded by the witnesses seeing a young girl standing in the ditch by the side of the road and then disappearing. There are stories, some of which I couldn't use because I wasn't able to obtain permissions from the reporting organizations, but there are stories of Sasquatch disappearing just in an instant. An enormous beast crosses the road and then disappears in the bush on the other side, or even in one particular case, which again, I don't believe I was able to use, Bigfoot crosses the road from down a slope on the left, crosses the road, and then on the right-hand side is an enormous drop to a rocky riverbed. And he stepped over and was gone. Unless he used some kind of great kung fu move that I've missed, he just disappeared. And of course, this kind of high strangeness isn't unusual with Bigfoot cases, but it's certainly, I know, unpopular in what you might call the mainstream Bigfoot groups, which want to advocate for a very nuts and bolts, flesh and blood definition of what Bigfoot is. I'm not coming down one way or the other, but definitely there are stories where these various things come together, including stories where historical events seem to repeat to a certain degree. Now, unfortunately, that story I have to keep to my chest. But there is, I do definitely have one instance where echoes of an event seem to replay and affect a particular area. So yeah. I do think they are somehow related, but I honestly am not, I have yet to divine exactly what the connecting thread is.
When you talk about replays, I think about something that the great researcher Lloyd Auerbach shared with me on one of the programs not that long ago for the last few months. He had been hired by a television show called Sightings, which I believe was out in the 90s, to do an investigation or some research on a place where a murder had been committed. And people would see the murder replayed time after time, the murderer and the victim. And people would report seeing this repeated. Now, the thing is that that's strange enough. But the fact was that the murderer was still alive and was on death row. And I thought that was, if I'm remembering correctly, I think he was on death row, but he's certainly in prison. And I thought that was amazing because I think a lot of times we assume these things are dead people. When they may not be dead people, they may just be some kind of replay of a psychically charged area in some way. And I use that that phrase all the time, the stone tape theory. I actually had the person transcribing my campfire book number 5, and I mentioned that in the transcript. She put stoned ape, like a gorilla theory. And I'm like, no, it's not a stoned gorilla. It's a stone tape theory. But anyway, I think that's fascinating, the replay piece of it. And when we get back, I'd like to, Brennan, with your permission, go over some of the stories. I mean, there's certainly a ton there. You have to pick up the book to get the full flavor, but we're going to go over a couple of them here on the Paranormal Podcast when we rejoin Brennan Storr and talk about A Strange Little Place right after this. The Paranormal Podcast is brought to you by Scott eVest. Great clothing plus tons of pockets for your stuff. Well, that's Scott eVest. To learn more and get a super special Scott eVest deal, go to jimherold.com/vest. That's jimherold.com/vest. Click on the link I provide there and use the coupon code JIMHERALD, that's one word, and you'll get 20% off your purchase. Now, fall is coming, believe it or not, and it's a great time to get introduced to the world of Scott eVest. Scott eVest is a clothing company with a difference. They believe in the power of pockets, and they sew a ton of pockets into high-quality clothing. We could be talking about jackets. We could be talking about vests. We could be talking about pants. We could be talking about shirts. They do a great job. Now, what does a Scott eVest mean? It means that you're always going to be able to keep track of your stuff. Scott eVest clothing provides a comfortable way for you to carry all of your stuff, keys, wallets, phone, boarding pass, dog treats, water bottles, computer tablets, your phone. If there's something that you carry around, you can put it in your Scott eVest. It frees up your hands. You know, if you want to drink a cup of coffee, you don't have to juggle keys and all these different things, opening a door, carrying your child. With Scott eVest, you're free to do it all because you're not holding on to stuff. It's all contained in that Scott eVest. And here's something that I love. You know, I'm a big audio guy, and I love to listen to podcasts and music on the go. Well, all of their clothes, in terms of their jackets and their vests, they have this thing that they call the personal area network. It's so unique, it's actually patented. It includes a clear touch internal pocket for your device and a cord management system that integrates your headphone cord. So you basically put your jacket on, you put your vest on, you plug in, your earphones are right built into this vest. And it's fantastic. I mean, it's just one of the nicest features that they have. And Scott eVest is designed to move with you. They're comfortable. They have things like removable sleeves, weight management system, lightweight water-resistant fabrics, so you're always prepared no matter what the weather is, and it protects your stuff. Now, recently, Scott eVest, I was really flattered, and I just caught this. They didn't even tell me. They put me on a Twitter list of influencers, which was an honor, but I got to tell you, it's kind of funny because I'm like a little guy. These days, a ton of celebrities from Hollywood and Silicon Valley, well, they're becoming Scott eVest aficionados just like me. And I've got a deal for you so you can become one because I'm telling you, you're going to love this. People are telling me I'm getting the vest for myself. I'm getting for other people. I'm getting the jackets for myself and other people. And universally, everybody said they love it. So you can join the club. Join me and all my Hollywood celebrity friends and go to jimherold.com/vest. That's jimherold.com/vest. Click on the link I provide there and use the coupon code JimHerold. That's one word, JimHerold, and you'll get 20% off your purchase. What a deal. Discover the power of the pocket. Go to jimherold.com/vest and use that promo code JimHerold. One word. That's one word. And you'll get 20% off your purchase. Thanks, Scott Evest. We're back on the Paranormal Podcast. Our guest is Brennan Storr. He is the author of the new book, A Strange Little Place, The Hauntings and Unexplained Events of a Small Town. And we're so glad to have him with us today. And we're going to talk about some stories in this book. Brennan, what about this one? Now, this one captured my attention. Louie, You're Dead.
So the story of Louie, You're Dead came to me from a man who used to run a bed and breakfast just south of town. He's a horse trainer. He lives in Arizona now. Very, very practical man. So I was surprised when he told me the story. But as the story goes, I believe it was in the 1970s, his then father-in-law, Louie, passed from cancer. And towards the end of his life, he was in, as I understand it, a great deal of pain. So several weeks after his death, this rancher was lying in bed. And he woke up about, say, 2 or 3 in the morning. And his wife was still asleep next to him. But he could see that the little breakfast nook just off his bedroom, the light was on. And he thought, well, that's strange. I'm certain I turned that off. So he got out of bed and shuffled over into the kitchen. And sitting in the breakfast nook, looking fresh as a daisy with his hair slicked back and his glasses on, was his father-in-law, Louie.
Oh, my.
And the man was stunned, as you can imagine.
Sure.
And he said, and I love this, he said, Louie, what are you doing here? You're dead. And Louie looked at him and said, I just had to come back to tell you, to tell everyone else, that I'm okay and I'm not hurting anymore.
Wow.
I need you to do that for me. And then he was gone. And not only was he gone, but the light in the kitchen was off.
Wow. Wow. But you know, this is something, and I say it with my campfire stories, I love these kind of stories because not every, quote, ghost story has to be, you know, you're going to be terrified, we're going to scare you, and all these. Some of them can be quite touching, actually.
Absolutely. Actually, I was just contacted by a fellow. I'm sure he won't mind me saying his name. I hope he doesn't. Jess. Who told me some really beautiful stories about his grandfather who died quite young and who still keeps an eye on the family. And it's just, I think stuff like that is really wonderful because absolutely, it doesn't have to be scary. There's, I believe, a whole other world outside our perception. And it's not all a horror movie. It's just as beautiful and wonderful and terrible as the one we live in.
Now, this one has kind of an ominous title, Green Light. What is Green Light?
So the green light is actually a personal story. And at first, I was very resistant to telling my own stories for a variety of reasons. But eventually, I relented, and this story was one of them. So when I was, I want to say in my early teens, I was a very boring teen, as I am a very boring adult. And on New Year's Eve, my friend and I were out shoveling my mother's driveway at about 3 in the morning. It was a snowy day, or night rather. It was coming down wet and heavy. You know, the kind of snow that just, if you let it sit, it's going to freeze and
yep.
Then you can't. So we're shoveling because we're awake on probably toxic levels of sugar and caffeine. And as we stood there in the driveway, from above a mountain, I saw it as, I believe it was Mount Revelstoke to me, but to my friend, he saw it coming from over Boulder Mountain. For there was a green flash in the sky, bright neon green. And then just as we looked at each other and thought, what was that? The air around us turned green. Now, I don't mean someone was shining a green light on us. I mean, for just a moment, it was like we were standing in a green sea. And I remember looking at my hand through this green haze and thinking, what's going on? And then it was gone. And we looked at each other and we thought, well, I guess that's enough shoveling for the night. Wet inside. So that was, I say, probably about 20 years ago now. But recently, while researching the book, I ran into a young Australian girl who told me a story that took me right back to that day in my mother, that night in my mother's driveway. She was on a backpacking trip in Australia's Blue Mountains with friends. And one night, after having set their tents and their sleeping bags up, they were lying in a field having a beer, when this girl saw in the sky this enormous green light that got closer and closer. And as it approached, she could see it was swirling like an energy ball. She thought it was a comet, and it was coming fast. And she braced for impact. She closed her eyes because she thought, this is the end of the world. We're done. And she felt the impact. Didn't hear it, but she felt it. She said she felt the ground shake, and she felt this wave of energy shoot through her body, and she screamed, and it was over. Her friends looked at her and said, "What is wrong with you, man?" And she opened her eyes to look around, saw that nothing had changed. Everything was fine. But she had seen that green light just as I had. And I have no explanation for either instance, but it makes you wonder.
Yeah, it does make you wonder. And the thing is that strange visions in the sky, I have my own green light sighting, nothing supernatural, but it was very odd. I remember this had to be 10 years ago, or maybe longer probably, before I ever did any of the podcasts. And my wife and I were driving down a major commercial strip here, not deserted. It was about 5:30 at night, 6 o'clock. This is the winter time, so it was dark. And we saw this green light in the sky. It looked like a fireball. It almost looked like space junk re-entering the atmosphere. And there were sparks flying over it, and it was very clear. And both of us saw it was kind of not a lime green, but a little darker than that, maybe more of a neon green. And it was definitely there. And we were listening to a radio show, a local talk show, and somebody called in and said, "I'm on XYZ Road, and I'm seeing this." And the host just kind of blew off and laughed at him and was like, "Go have another drink, buddy," or something, and then hung up on him. And again, it might have been space junk or something, but I guess that technically would be a UFO sighting, unidentified flying object, right?
I guess it would. It's certainly unidentified. It appeared to be flying.
Yeah. Now, it might have been space junk, but I just really thought that was weird. And it shows you how quickly people are willing to dismiss something like that when, in actuality, I saw it, my wife saw it, and this other person who we have no idea was saw it. So it must have been there. So just wonder how many times that happens around the world every day. And then another story here that I want to touch on before we go, and this one sounds kind of ominous. The man in the field. Tell us about the man in the field.
The man in the field is ominous, but it's also a little fun. And in this story, the story is set in a part of Revelstoke called Big Eddy. Now, of course, Revelstoke's not very big, but it's big enough to have a few neighborhoods. Big Eddy was once a farming community until the highway came, and it's been bisected and cut apart by roads. But back when it was a farming community, the man I spoke to, him and his family rented a two-story farmhouse, which was right next to a pasture and had a large front porch where everyone would sleep when the nights got hot. So eventually they were forced to move. The farmhouse sold, and they had to relocate. And they would walk past the farmhouse every day on the way to school, the children. And in the yard of their former house, they would see this old man who had bought the house. And the old man always wore a black hat. They'd see him tending to the animals, and they'd move on. Well, eventually the man passed, and the family was offered the opportunity to rent the farmhouse again, which they did. What they found, however, was that oftentimes in the morning, the chain would be off the pasture enclosure, and the cows would be wandering hither and yon, munching on Mrs. Wilson's flowers. And this was a source of some consternation. But they could never figure out who was doing it until early one morning, I guess you'd say. The family was out sleeping on the porch because, again, it had been a hot night in the summer. And one of the boys woke up early. It was just at that point where night is tipping into morning. And he looked out towards the pasture, and he saw what he saw was someone standing by the chain link, by the chain fence. And he saw this person grab the chain, pick it up, drop it on the ground so the cows could move freely. And that figure was wearing a black hat.
Huh.
And at that moment, the dogs went crazy. He had two large collie dogs. They started barking and barking, and that seemed to break whatever spell he was under, and he couldn't see the figure anymore. But the cows were still roaming free. It never happened again after that night. But for whatever reason, the man who had, it seems as though the man who had previously owned the space decided to have a little bit of fun with the people who took it back from him.
I mean, that's really, that's some story. I love those kinds of stories. And it's just one of those things. Again, these stories are dramatic. They're not, some of them may be, but it's not having long-term conversations with ghosts. All of those, I guess, Louis, you're dead, you kind of did, or the person there. But sometimes these have the ring of truth to me. Like sometimes we hear the more incredible ghost stories and, it seems as though, you kind of wonder. But I love about your book and your stories, these all have the ring of just regular folks telling their regular stories of things that really happened.
And I appreciate that. And that was something I really tried to do, was weed out what I call jumped up horror movie nonsense.
Right.
And there were stories like that. I had crazy stories about things flying across rooms and being attacked, physically attacked by things. And I have what I like to call a pretty well-honed BS detector. And some of those stories really set it off. So they were not included. But the ones that remain are from people who I sat with and believed and heard their stories, looked in their eyes, and I believed what they were telling me.
And I bet you a considerable number of those people said, never experienced anything before or since. This is my one strange story.
Absolutely. Most of those people, particularly there's one story called The House on the Bank, which obviously we won't get into here, but people who pick up the book will be able to see it. And that story includes, I want to say, four different generations of people, all of whom have just this one experience, all of whom are working class people who do not spin stories, but had these very similar unusual experiences in one little house.
Brennan, where can people pick up the book and also check out your blog? Because I know you write a lot there as well.
I do, yeah. So the book is available on Amazon, of course, Barnes & Noble. For Canadian listeners, it's available at Chapters Indigo as well. And you can, of course, find me at largelythetruth.com. I'm on Instagram and Twitter. Feel free to shoot me a message. And for those of you who are in Canada, we have two signings coming up. So if you'd like to come by, pick up a copy of the book and have a chat, I would love to see you. The first will be in Vernon, BC on August 26th at Bookland Books. It'll be from 12 to 2 p.m. And the one following that will be on August 27th, Saturday, in Revelstoke, the very strange little place itself, at Grizzly Books from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. And then on September 30th, we'll be having a signing here in Victoria, BC, Chapters on Douglas Street from 2 to 4 p.m. So if you'd love to, if you'd like to come by, I would very much like to see you. I'm a talker, as you can see, and I would very much like to hear what you have to say.
Very good. The book is A Strange Little Place, The Hauntings and Unexplained Events of One Small Town. Our guest has been the author, Brennan Storr. Brennan, thank you for joining us, and all the luck in the world with the book.
Thank you very much, Jim. I appreciate it.
Well, I hope that you enjoyed this show as much as I did. And a couple of notes. If you want to get in on my Plus Club at jimherold.net and you want to save some money, you have some limited time. We have a summer sale that will be ending after Labor Day, the U.S. Labor Day, which is coming up this coming Monday. Once Monday is over, it will go back to the full price for a yearly membership. So I would say run, don't walk, over to jimherold.net and check that out. 1,200 podcasts you can't get on the free feed, and so much more. And then secondly, don't forget my adult coloring book, True Ghost Stories, created by fantastic artist Len Peralta, with campfire stories brought to life in these pages of this coloring book. It's got all 5-star reviews thus far over at Amazon, and I think that you'll like it. You can check it out at Amazon.com, Amazon.co.uk, all the other Amazon stores. And for the direct links, you can just go to jimherrellbooks.com. We thank you so much. I hope that you're enjoying the show. And please, please, during this spooky season, with their permission, take your friend's cell phone who enjoys paranormal stuff. And with their permission, subscribe them, whether they're on an iPhone or an Android. There's so many ways to listen to the content these days. With their permission, subscribe them to the Paranormal Podcast and my other free podcast, Jim Harold's Campfire. We thank you so much. We'll talk to you next time. Have a great weekend. Stay spooky. Bye-bye, everybody. Now for the legal disclaimer. We do not accept money from publishers or content producers in exchange for interviews. However, as with most media outlets, in the majority of cases, we do receive complimentary copies of books and DVDs that we feature on our podcasts. Your purchases of books, DVDs, and other items via our Amazon.com links benefit Jim Harold and JimHarold.com and help us continue our programming. The sponsor messages you hear on the programs are paid endorsements, although we really do like them. For the full disclaimer, go to JimHarold.com, and thanks for listening.